at northlandfdn.org. Lows tonight, 9 to 16 below, and highs tomorrow, 0 to 5.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
No deal. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi says if Minnesota wants to, quote, bring an end to the chaos, it just needs to hand over its voter rolls as well as some other sensitive information. Minnesota's Secretary of State tells us that feels a lot like a ransom. He has no plans to pay.
And fast enough food. A San Francisco reporter tells us why he leapt at the chance to run from one Taco Bell to a new location exactly 5K away while scarfing down three Crunchwrap Supremes. And why his body soon regretted his enthusiasm.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens in a few minutes here on KAXE. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic GigaZone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. And support comes from the Northwoods Pond Hockey Championship, taking place Saturday, February 14th on McKinney Lake in Grand Rapids, featuring food trucks, live music, and an open skating rink for skaters of all ages. The event is open to all spectators, with more information at northwoodspondhockey.com. Let's take a listen to our album of the week. It is called World's Gone Wrong by Lucinda Williams. It is her 16th album, comprised of original songs written by Lucinda Williams. And the 72-year-old and stroke survivor has written protest songs that meet the moment. You can let us know what you think. Text us, 218-326-1234. The song we are going to hear this evening is called How Much Did You Get for Your Soul?
The whole world, but for profits and soul in the plan. We've seen this many times before. There were others who take on the deal. Robert Johnson went down to the crossroads. Why don't you ask him, how does it feel?
I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening. I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
state of shock while Minneapolis deals with ICE agents on its streets and two shooting deaths at the hands of those agents. The U.S. Attorney General is demanding Minnesota hand over its voter rolls. The Secretary of State tells us he has no plans to respond to what he calls ransom.
No port in a storm. A rescue organization in the Mediterranean says almost 400 migrants are feared dead after they tried to make the perilous crossing into Europe during last week's cyclone.
Sudden impact, millions of dollars worth of research equipment is destroyed when pipes burst at an aging Montreal hospital.
Their heads were swimming. Families were at a hotel in Canmore, Alberta for a hockey tournament, but a suspected chlorine leak meant kids wound up at the hospital instead of the rink.
Backbeat driver, we remember legendary drummer Sly Dunbar, a revered reggae artist and a prolific collaborator.
And he can walk the walk and talk the taco. When a San Francisco writer realized a new Taco Bell location was exactly 5K away from an existing Taco Bell location, he made an unwise decision to run from one to the other while eating Crunch Wraps Supreme. As it happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that considers this a worst quesadilla scenario. The top U.S. Border Patrol official in Minneapolis is no longer in Minneapolis. But the protests continue as people wait to see if the departure of Gregory Bovino will do anything to ease tensions there. Yesterday, President Donald Trump announced that he would send Border Czar Tom Homan to Minnesota to take over management of the administration's immigration crackdown in the city. Today, the president told Fox News, "We're going to de-escalate a little bit." This past weekend, federal officers shot and killed an ICU nurse. And U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi raised tensions further by sending a letter to Governor Tim Walz proposing three steps to, quote, bring an end to the chaos in Minnesota. They were share state welfare records, repeal the state's sanctuary policies, and give the Justice Department access to Minnesota's voter roll, unquote. Minnesota's Secretary of State, Steve Simon, says he'll do no such thing. We reached Secretary Simon in Washington, D.C.
Secretary Simon, Attorney General Bondi has called her demands, quote, common sense solutions. You've described what is in that letter as a, quote, ransom. That's certainly a strong word. Why do you feel it's warranted?
Well, I think she made the connection herself. She's suggesting a trade. And in this circumstance, I think it's a ransom because what's being held hostage is our security, our safety, our stability, our sense of peace all throughout the Minneapolis and St. Paul area. So that's why I made that comment. She's the one making an implied connection between the two.
You've also, in your response, said it is not the first time you've been pressured to hand over this kind of data. What has happened before?
Right. Well, starting last summer, the Department of Justice requested this exact information from 42 different states. Minnesota is among the 32 out of those 42 states that have said no. And the reason we've said no is we believe that the law is clear, that the law, federal and state law, do not entitle the Department of Justice to get this confidential, sensitive information on millions of people in our states. And she knows that, and she knows that this is in court right now. In fact, we have a hearing in early March. This is very much a live legal issue right now. It's just puzzling that she would connect it in this way when voter data has seemingly little or nothing to do with the facts on the ground, with force levels, with tactics, with immigration policy, with public safety.
Attorney General Bondi has said that the giving this information to the DOJ will help ensure free and fair elections and boost confidence in the rule of law. Why do you think the federal government in your country wants this information so badly?
It's hard to say. And if I knew, that might help resolve some of the legal issues. Our read of the law is that at a minimum, what the federal government has to do is describe with a specificity why they need this particular kind of data. And number two, they need to describe with specificity what they're going to do with the data. Who will they share it with? How will it be transmitted, stored, kept, secured, those kinds of things. And they've done none of those things. Keep in mind, this is really personal data on millions of people, and in the wrong hands could cause a lot of harm.
Yesterday, a judge shut down the federal government's attempt to obtain unredacted voter rolls in Oregon, citing Attorney General Bondi's demands in Minnesota as part of his concerns. Do you think that letter to Minnesota might have had the unintended effect of actually stopping other attempts to get that kind of information?
I do. I think it was an unforced error on the part of the Department of Justice. It suggests real credibility problems with their stated reasons for both launching ICE raids and for requesting the data itself. It's no secret that the Department of Justice over the last few months has had a serious credibility problem in court after court after court, caught stretching the truth, if not downright lying, in a number of instances. And that's a real concern. So I do think that this letter may end up having a further boomerang effect.
Yesterday on our show, our listeners heard from Zach Green. He's a Minnesotan. He was volunteering at this makeshift field hospital that healthcare workers had set up to help protesters around the area where ICU nurse Alex Preddy was killed by an ICE agent. You certainly know more than all of us even how tense it is and what a difficult time it is in the state. I want to play for you a little bit about what Zach Green said about what he would like to see from state officials.
I'd like to see them out in public. I'd like to see them out in the streets with us. I'd like to see them talking face-to-face with Bovino. I'd like to see them at the Whipple Building. I'd like to see them in my neighborhood checking on neighbors. There's just been this void, and it's just been press conference and press tour after press tour.
You know, I mentioned to Zach Green how strongly worded the statements, the public statements, and those press conferences have been from Governor Walz and the mayor, certainly. But what do you make of what he said? What would you say to those who agree with him?
I think he's being fair, reasonable, and correct. All of us, public officials and everyone, we have to show solidarity with one another. And by the way, I want to say, in Minnesota, both Democrats and Republicans have been calling for leaders to take the temperature down. But he's right that it's going to take all of us. He's right that it can't just be press appearances. It's got to be checking in on our neighbors and making sure our community is safe and stable and okay. We're going to persevere. We're going to get past this, but we've got to rely on one another.
Also, of course, we know that Gregory Bovino, who Zach Green mentioned there, the ICE commander, is being pulled out of Minneapolis. Tom Homan is going in. We mentioned on our show yesterday the conversation between Governor Walz and U.S. President Trump. We hear the mayor has spoken to the president as well. What do you think changed and triggered the shift, even softening, if we can use that word, in the president's tone?
I mean, I'd be guessing, but it has to be the fact that now a second U.S. citizen has been gunned down unnecessarily under really troubling circumstances by agents of the federal government. And you know, this long ago ceased being about sort of the pinpointed surgical targeting of the so-called worst of the worst. That's not at all what this is. That's not what I saw, what my family sees. It seemed aimless. It seemed wanton. It seemed unnecessarily cruel. And I will say these steps in the right direction are welcome. Mm-hmm. I think we have to take many more steps in that same direction, and I'd like to see this siege end.
Secretary Simon, I appreciate this. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We reached Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon in Washington, D.C. Normally, the research wing of Montreal's Douglas Mental Health Institute is a hub of activity, but today it's closed. It was shut down because of severe flooding after a burst water pipe damaged four of the facility's laboratories. That left Sylvain Williams and his colleagues scrambling as they tried to minimize the damage. Mr. Williams is the director of the Neuroscience Research Unit at the Douglas, and we reached him in Montreal.
Sylvain, what do your labs look like today?
Well, it's pretty chaotic today. Yesterday was a horrible day. Things looks like it's in shambles. Actually, the whole building is closed right now because trying to remove the water at this point.
I would imagine, even if the building is aging, that the equipment that you're using there is expensive and much needed. So what has happened to that equipment and the important samples and research you have there?
We could actually save a lot of the instruments, but many of the instruments, there was a lot of water in the instruments. So these are very sophisticated apparatus. And this is going to cause a major slowdown. There were some samples being run, so some samples for genomics and molecular biology in different experiments. So obviously these samples are lost because these instruments were lost, but there are other samples that will be used.
Do you have a sense at this stage, can you put a dollar figure on it in terms of the rebuilding?
Mm-hmm. Tomorrow, the assessment will be in cost of instruments and what is salvageable. So at this point, we don't know, but certainly, obviously, several millions of dollars were lost.
I've seen some of the video from what happened. When did you realize that this wasn't just a small leak, that this was very serious?
Yeah, my colleague told me that the labs were flooded, so I said, oh, boys, and he showed me a couple of pictures, and then I said, you know, okay, I'm going to take a look myself, so I went, and so the initial flood was on the second floor, because this is where the pipes bursted, so these are the pipes for the sprinklers. So the two labs that were below those sprinklers were flooded, and the water went to the first floor. So there were like already three labs that were heavily damaged by the water. The sprinkler system broke at other sections of the research center. Mm-hmm. And then it was havoc. I mean, on the two floors, everyone was running, trying to save the equipment.
And you've dealt with this kind of thing before. The hospital is more than 100 years old. There's been issues with conditions before. Were you worried that something like this was going to happen?
Yes, definitely. You know, so I was shocked by what I was seeing yesterday, but unfortunately, I wasn't surprised. So a couple of years ago, there was a pipe that bursted and the water went into the main electrical box, and that caused an important fire. But before that, there was also flooding, the roof was leaking, so, and that also severely damaged instruments back then. So these issues have been occurring again.
These are safety issues for the people who work there. It also seems like quite a waste of funding and important research. Why has this been allowed to continue? Why are these conditions still ongoing?
Well, that's a good question, you know. And we've been asking over and over again that, you know, we should have a new research center because the conditions are unbearable. And we should obviously have a new hospital for the patients for better care. And so in 2022, basically, the government here in Quebec started a program with us to actually start initiating a project for a new research center and a new hospital. But unfortunately, even though, you know, we work with the architects and engineers were paid by the government, everything was put on ice last year. So
why?
I don't know. You know, it's a political issue here. It's all about their priority. I think it's a recurring team in Quebec. These things happen often where they're started and then, okay, we have to stop all these different projects. They're all important, but we have to do this hospital here, which is, you know, is going to fall. But, you know, it's these things have been going on for decades.
Our Radio-Canada colleague spoke with Quebec's health minister, Sonia Bélanger. She said she's aware of the flooding, agrees that renovations are necessary, but says there are no plans to do those renovations at the moment. Mm. How long do you think you could be waiting?
It's really unfortunate, you know, because we've been putting a Band-Aid on this situation for a very long time. And it's also the safety of the people working here and the safety of the students. You know, we have hundreds of, at least 100 students training, working in this building.
What are you telling your students?
The only thing that's very positive here is that we have an incredible group of scientists considered leaders in Canada and the world in this type of research for mental health and Alzheimer's disease and so on. So that's why the students keep on coming. But unfortunately, you know, we are working in an infrastructure that is less than inspiring.
When might you all be able to get back to work?
Yeah, we don't know right now. And there's a lot of weight on the floors of these buildings. You know, this is all wood. It's something we have on our mind when we go into this building.
Sylvain, I appreciate this. Please take care.
Thank you very much.
Sylvain Williams is the director of the Neuroscience Research Unit at the Douglas Mental Health Institute. He's in Montreal. We contacted the provincial government agency that oversees the hospital. In a statement, it said that the flooding was caused by unfavorable weather conditions and that it's working as fast as possible to allow hospital staff to get back to work. Some people get very excited when a master chef opens a new restaurant with like three seats that's open only every other Tuesday for half an hour and serves only a delicately spiced soup of pureed celery. And some people get very excited about a new Taco Bell. Earlier this month, we told you about Jeff Hilliard in Mount Pearl, Newfoundland and Labrador. He had done a tremendous public service by creating a website that tracks wait times at the city's new Taco Bell. It was the first Taco Bell to open in the province in years, and people were waiting long hours in a lineup to place their orders. The traffic got so bad that the city had to issue a traffic notice for the area.
I would have said that I didn't think there was anybody more excited than me for Taco Bell to open, but I never would have waited 3 or 4 hours in the lineup for it. So I guess there were a lot of people that were more excited. But yeah, it seems like nobody expected it to be this busy for this long.
Well, now another Taco Bell has inspired another kind of public experiment. San Francisco's second Taco Bell Cantina, it's like a fancier Taco Bell that serves booze, opened last week in Fisherman's Wharf. And one writer decided to mark the occasion by lacing up his running shoes and running 5 kilometers from one Taco Bell Cantina to the new one on the waterfront. In so doing, he answered a question that no one had asked. Can you run a 5K at a respectable pace while eating 3 Crunchwrap Supremes? Timothy Karoff is a culture reporter with SF Gate. We reached him in San Francisco.
Timothy, why? Why did you do this?
Oh, God. I often look around on Reddit for stories. I'm a local journalist, and there was a new Taco Bell Cantina, which is like a normal taco, except they also serve alcohol. and somebody had found out on Reddit that I think it was exactly 3.1 miles between the other Taco Bell cantina in the city and this new one, which is a 5K. And so I posted that in our Slack channel, and I was like, oh, this is kind of funny, ha ha ha. And my editor said, oh, you should do that. And so there have been like Taco Bell marathons in San Francisco already, where people had like run, you know, the whole 26.2 miles while also stopping to eat. So I figured, 5K isn't that impressive. Maybe I could try to run while eating. In general, I'm really happy to leave the office whenever I can for an assignment. I'm a big Taco Bell fan. Whenever I'm on a road trip with my friends, I'll kind of strongly push to make a stop there. And I like to run. So it seemed on paper to be something that I would like to do.
So how did you settle on, a lot to choose from on the menu, certainly. How did you settle on the Crunchwrap Supreme? And then not only settle on that, but times three.
Okay, so it's Crunchwrap Supreme is a very classic Taco Bell menu item. It's shaped like a hexagon, and it's got this very specific architecture where it's got this soft tortilla wrapped on the outside and then a tostada on the inside, which kind of provides this backbone for it. It's like designed to be like the perfect to-go food. I normally eat two in a sitting, but I kind of figured, okay, if I'm going to try to run a 30-minute 5K, then that's like roughly three 10-minute segments. And so three felt right. And also, you know, like the kind of the rule of threes, like,
yeah,
two isn't very interesting. Three is just a good number.
Sure.
It wasn't really much of a rhyme.
Did your body feel that way? Did your body feel that that was a great number as you were running and eating them?
My body screamed no. Oh, my body did not feel that way.
How long into the run did it start screaming?
I think it was around like midway through the second Crunchwrap. So the first one, I ate pretty quickly and I hadn't had lunch yet. It was 2 p.m. And so I was actually pretty grateful to be eating. And then I got to the waterfront and I started eating the second one. And that one started going a lot more slowly. And I think all of the reasons why people don't run while eating kind of dawned on me at once. I think I took for granted that when I sit down to eat in my home or at my workplace, I'm normally just kind of chewing and swallowing without thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And this time around, I kind of felt like I was almost like a puppeteer of my jaw. That sounds kind of gross, but like, I don't know how else to put it.
No,
like,
I see what you mean.
I did to consciously choose to chew and swallow every single bite.
Otherwise, you were going to vomit, I would imagine.
Yeah, I was going to vomit or like choke. At the same time, I started like sweating. My mouth, this is kind of gross. My mouth kind of filled up with saliva, but also kind of dried out from the cheese because I forgot to drink water beforehand too. And at the same time, my nose started running. And the Crunchwrap Supreme also, which is this marvel of architecture, kind of started failing a little bit. Like, I think the bean juice and the sour cream and the tomatoes kind of had started softening the tostada in the middle from shaking around so much. And some of like the sour cream and cheese was leaking out the little opening at the top.
And also ultimately, you had these goals, three Crunchwraps while running a 5K, hopefully doing it in less than half an hour. Did you succeed?
No, I didn't. I got through half of the third Crunchwrap by the time that I made it to the Taco Bell Cantina in Fisherman's Wharf. By then, I was like, this is the last thing that I want to put into my body. And I kind of had a moment where I was like, oh, I don't have to do this. I can just throw this out. And also, I think I ran like 33 minutes, 59 seconds for the whole 5K.
Okay.
And then I shuffled into the cantina and I had my second Baja Blast.
What is a Baja Blast?
A turquoise slushy soda that Taco Bell sells. I'm pretty sure it's proprietary and also somehow a Mountain Dew product. I'm not quite clear on the licensing.
Were you sick in any way after this?
My stomach felt pretty bad. Luckily, I don't throw up very often.
Okay.
I felt like, the closest I felt like throwing up was when I started drinking my second Baja Blast. And I was like, oh my God, there's way too much like liquid and bits and whatever in my stomach right now. Like I took one sip that was too big and I was like, oh.
You've underlined that people should not do this at home. I will underline that as well. Lots of reasons. Choking hazard at the top of the list, certainly. You said you loved Taco Bell. Do you still feel that way after this experience? Are you going back for the Baja Blast and the Crunchwrap Supreme?
I think I'm going to take a sabbatical.
Okay.
I think I need at least a couple of months, probably a year. I think I'll be eating more salads for at least the coming weeks.
Okay, Timothy. Well, thank you for your sacrifice for your journalism. We appreciate it.
The sword.
Thanks, Timothy.
Thank you so much.
Timothy Karoff is a culture reporter with SF Gate. He's in San Francisco. Sly Dunbar began his career playing on tin cans, and by the end of it, he was one of the most revered reggae musicians of his generation. Sly Dunbar, probably best known as half of the duo Sly and Robbie, died yesterday morning. He was 73. He met bassist Robbie Shakespeare in his teens, and the two formed the rhythm section of the band The Revolutionaries. Their partnership would span decades and transcend musical genres. In 1979, the producer Brian Eno told the New Music New York Festival, quote, "When you buy a reggae record, there's a 90% chance the drummer is Sly Dunbar," unquote. But the pair played on many recordings in other genres as well. Over the years, Sly and Robbie collaborated with Bob Marley, the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, No Doubt, Sinead O'Connor, and many, many more. At one point, they estimated they had played on 200,000 recordings. In 2021, Mr. Dunbar was a guest on this program after his friend and fellow musician Bunny Wailer died. He talked about what it was like to work with the icon after growing up with his music.
When I was like a kid, like 10 years old, I went to the stage show, and the Wailers was on the stage show.
Oh, wow.
And I saw him, but I used to listen to their records on the radio. And when I heard his first song, Simmer Down, it blew me away, you know? And they never turned back from Simmer Down. They get better and better with him as being part of the Wailers, you know?
So to go from that, being a 10-year-old kid watching him play, to playing drums on one of his tracks, what kind of a journey must that have been like?
Well, it's a long journey, because one of the time I couldn't believe it when I got hooked up with him through Robbie, you know?
Right.
He wanted me and Robbie to play in his song, and I felt great because we were friends with Peter Touch then, you know, and then even Peter was like good friends. So Bunny and Peter used to hang out together, you know, so.
Right.
And I felt great to play on a Bunny Wailer's record, you know.
From our archives, that was Sly Dunbar talking to As It Happens guest host Peter Armstrong in 2021. Mr. Dunbar has died at the age of 73. And here's one of 200,000 examples of his genius. The Mighty Diamonds, Sly Dunbar on drums with Right Time. Mighty Diamonds with Right Time.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, a member of a migrant rescue group describes what happened when Cyclone Harry hit the Mediterranean and says it is just the latest extreme example of the kind of tragedy he sees all too often.
And Hidden Figure. Bobby Wine's wife says that Ugandan soldiers raided their home and assaulted her when she wouldn't give up the opposition leader's location. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Thanks for listening to As It Happens on KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, Sarah Sarah, your volunteer host for On the River. It's a great mix of music. More great music continues at 10 o'clock, Headwaters with DJ Dang. Support comes from Bemidji Brewing at 211 America Avenue in downtown Bemidji. Their new year starts with beer infusions and events such as Tropical Escape Week, featuring live music and tiki glassware. More at bemidjibeer.com. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. We also thank North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at northhomes.org. Temperatures tonight 9 to 16 below and tomorrow mostly sunny with highs 0 to 5, northwest wind up to 20 miles per hour. Tune in tomorrow morning at 8:45 for Area Voices. We'll hear about Bemidji Community Theater's production of Clue. Now more from As It Happens.
Even people in sturdy buildings along the Italian coastline were battered by last week's Cyclone Harry. And as the storm made its way across the Mediterranean, hundreds of vulnerable people were out on the water, packed into dinghies and small boats. The Italian Coast Guard is now estimating that up to 380 migrants may have drowned trying to make the crossing during the cyclone. One of the boats that sank was carrying 50 people, one of whom miraculously survived after 24 hours at sea. Francesco Creazzo is a spokesperson for SOS Mediterranee, which operates a migrant rescue ship. We reached him in Reggio Calabria, Italy.
Francesco, I know your rescue ship just left port today. It's the first time it's going out since the cyclone hit. What is the team hoping that ship can achieve?
The team is hoping to do their usual job, so to rescue lives in the central Mediterranean, which is still the deadliest sea migration route in the world. We did so up until just before the Cyclone Harry hit, and we brought 90 people to safety in Palermo on the 20th of January.
How does the cyclone, though, the aftermath of the cyclone and the number of people who are lost, believed to be lost, how does that change the kind of work you've done for so long now?
Short answer is it doesn't, because it's unfortunately this is a graver occurrence of a recurring situation. The Mediterranean has been turned by European policies and by the sheer dangerousness of the crossing into a mass grave, where we think that not we but the International Organization for Migration of the UN estimates that 20,000 to 30,000 people have died over the last 10 years. Unfortunately, these deaths are shocking, of course, mm-hmm. tragic, but nothing new, and they are due to the inaction and lack of coordination of competent authorities that should preside over the area.
We've covered many of these stories, these tragedies, these preventable disasters, as others we've spoken to have pointed out. In terms of what people are telling you about what it was like to be on the water, just people who were on even larger ships, not the migrants we're talking about, to give our listeners a sense of what was happening on the water, the strength of this cyclone. What did people say that cyclone felt like?
We don't have direct confirmation or testimonies from the cyclone because we were saving people, rescuing people in the Med just before and just after. We have a 70 meter ship, steel ship, and we had to shelter with that ship. So we're talking about 8 meters waves. So we have no idea of the fate of the people and how it felt like. What we can say is the state we found the last rescue we did in, and the sea was already kind of rough. So we found them profoundly dehydrated, despite the best efforts of the crew of Cider to provide them with food and water. And we had to activate an MCP, a mass casualty plan, to ensure that they would recover, which they did. But this is, again, a failure of the states that didn't take care of them.
The people who you were able to rescue, can you tell us a little bit more about them, where they're from, who they are, their ages?
In total, 90 people were from 2 different rescues. The last one was the one I just talked about on merchant vessel Cider. And the other rescue a couple of days earlier was a rubber boat in distress, a makeshift rubber boat, 44 people on board, all from war-torn Sudan, including 3 women and 2 children of less than 1 year of age.
Even if there were cyclone warnings, when you talk about where people are coming from, can you still understand the kinds of risks they're taking and why they're taking those risks?
Well, in the case of Sudanese people, for example, they are fleeing war. Mm-hmm. They are fleeing civil war at home. And then they find themselves stuck in Libya, which is not safe for them. And, of course, even with good weather, nobody would attempt a crossing over more than 150 miles of water on a makeshift rubber boat or fiberglass boat unless they have no choice. Even more when the weather is rough, we are told by some survivors that smugglers who have absolutely no moral scruples in doing so, they are ruthless, and sometimes the people are forced by them onto boats.
You talked about how long you've been doing this work. We've covered it, as I've said, so many cases, so many deaths over and over again, the same scenario. Will this one, will the numbers, the fact that there was a cyclone, change anything in terms of government response or policies?
I really don't think so. Unfortunately, this is using the lack of rescue capacity, abandoning the rescue capacity by coast guards and turning the Mediterranean into a void. It's a policy that is deliberately being pursued by European states as a means of deterrence. They try to make people not leave in order to push them back. And I don't think the case of the 380 people missing from the cyclone is going to deter. This is a well-established policy.
Francesco, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Francesco Creazzo is a spokesperson for SOS Mediterranee. We reached him in Reggio Calabria, Italy. Thank you. From her hospital bed, Barbara Chagulani has a message for her husband. Stay hidden. Her husband is Bobby Wine, the musician turned Ugandan opposition leader who has been evading the military since a disputed presidential election earlier this month. The winner of that election was no surprise. 81-year-old Yoweri Museveni has been the president since 1986. But Mr. Wine rejected those results. And since then, the military has been looking for him, saying without evidence that he's a criminal. And this past weekend, his wife says, dozens of men, some in military uniforms, raided their home in the middle of the night. Uganda's military chief denies that soldiers assaulted her. Here's how Ms. Chagulani describes it.
He held the trousers of the nightie and pulled me up. Then he held the shirt of the nightie from the back. He was using one arm, so he held it. Then he brought the phone in front of me and said, remove the password. I said, I have told you I will not remove the password. The one that he came with held me in the neck here and lifted me off my feet in the neck like this. That same man held me by my hair, lifted me up. We have poles in the sitting room, and hit my head on the pole and slit my mouth. Then he said, will you give me the password? I said again in Unyankore, you have already done enough. You are not getting the password. So in that moment, they were already picking the camera controllers. They were already picking the MiFi. They were already picking all the phones in the room. They took AirPods, chargers, power banks, woofers, radios, anything electrical, laptops, everything. And then another one asked me and says, "Okashwerwo mwinazi w'Omuganda abanyankore okota kubareba. You got married to a..." I don't know what they call a mwinazi. What do they call a mwinazi in English? A mwinazi is like a traitor. It's like the worst person that there can be in the world. He said, you married that traitor of a Muganda.
That was Barbara Chagulani speaking from a hospital. She says Ugandan soldiers assaulted her so she would tell them where her husband, Bobby Wine, is hiding. It was the kind of end to a tournament weekend that hockey parents will recognize. There'd been back-to-back games, a lot of running around in the hotel hallways, no doubt. And then, before the last games of the U7 tournament in Canmore, Alberta, on Sunday, the kids spent the morning burning off some energy in the hotel pool. But the weekend didn't end on the rink. Instead, 11 children ended up in the hospital from a suspected chlorine leak. Jennifer Stevenson was there with her 6-year-old son, Oliver. We reached Ms. Stevenson in Calgary.
Jennifer, how is Oliver doing today?
He's doing okay. He's better. He's back at school today.
How do you feel about that?
Good. Like, obviously.
When did you get a sense, though, if we go back, you know, to the weekend, mm-hmm. when did you get a sense that something wasn't right?
He came to me. Mm-hmm. He had made a pit stop in the hot tub on the way to the slide stairs. And he came to me and said that the hot tub was making him cough. And I was, "Why? Do you want to go then?" And he said, "No." And then we sort of just looked around and saw that all of a sudden everyone was coughing. And then all of a sudden a lot of kids were throwing up everywhere.
Oh no. What are you thinking as you see all of that happening?
Like, I just want to get out of there.
Yeah.
So I wrapped a towel around him, and I'm pretty sure we were one of the first ones, if not the first, to exit the pool area.
And how quickly from when he tells you something's not right to that scene?
Maybe 5 seconds.
Oh, my.
It was instant. Everything happened all at the same time. It was wild.
And Kenmore Fire Rescue says about 30 children in the pool area were in that condition.
Yeah, I would say that's about right.
Yeah, did you smell or sense anything before Oliver told you that, that there was that smell?
I mean, I didn't sense anything off. It's just a stuffy pool room. I mean, we had been in there for a long time already. So to me, I didn't notice, but where I was sitting was kind of behind a wall. So it's possible that others would have smelt it, and where I was, I just wouldn't have.
Yeah. And so after you wrapping him in the towel, how long after that did you think maybe we should go to the hospital?
Well, we were, yeah, we went upstairs, mm-hmm. and my first instinct was to just shower him off. He was coughing, and I kept mm-hmm. trying to ask him to stop, and he couldn't. And then once I got him dressed after the shower and he was still coughing, we went downstairs to see if anyone had called an ambulance. And of course, that's when we noticed that that there were multiple ambulances and fire trucks and stuff there. So we were put into this room for to wait to be assessed by the paramedics.
And what did the paramedics say once they got a look and heard the cough and saw Oliver?
Well, they sort of did children one by one. We were one of the last ones. He wasn't coughing anymore by the time we got down there. Some of the kids who were got seen first, which makes sense. But yeah, they checked his vitals, and they had announced to everyone that if you wanted to be seen by a doctor, that to go to the Canmore Hospital, which was pretty much right across the street.
And what did those test results say? I mean, did they give you a clear picture of what might have happened, what this was all about?
Yeah, so we got the blood test results back, and they were looking for an elevated pH in the blood, like acidity, and Oliver's came back normal in that sense. So they said that since his skin was looking better and his breathing was okay and he'd been on the oxygen, the blood came back okay, that he was okay to leave. So that was a big relief.
Yeah, that those minutes, those hours, I mean, you're calm now and everyone seems to be all right, but I mean, it sounds terrifying as, you know, for someone, the parent of a small child.
Oh, for sure. When we, there were moments there where we didn't know what it was. We still don't know for sure what it was, but there was, you know, all of us were kind of separated into our little bed areas of the emergency room, and you're hearing things, you're hearing nurses and doctors talk about other kids, and then parents are coming and saying, oh, we heard them talking about your kid, and you just start panicking, like you just think the worst, and it's really hard to calm down.
I bet. In terms of what is known and what isn't known right now, we know the town of Canmore says that it suspects chlorine. Alberta Health Services and Fire Rescue are investigating. The hotel, Canmore Inn and Suites, says their pool systems are professionally operated and monitored by a licensed chemical management company. That company is also investigating, the hotel says. And they're also saying, you know, any rumors you're hearing about intentional poisoning or cyanide are not true. Mm-hmm. Do you feel comfortable with the level of response and answers you're getting at this stage?
I mean, I feel like I've had to do a lot of my own investigating to find out, to get some answers. The hotel certainly hasn't reached out other than sending all the guests the same thing that they posted publicly. So they haven't reached out to the specific families individually to see how they're doing. It's more of a, they're making sure their butt's covered kind of thing. But yeah, like I've reached out to, you know, people that I know in the medical field, and I've called poison control to sort of get some answers, and we've been to doctors and stuff because we just want to make sure that, you know, we're taking care of Oliver properly. I mean, when someone mentions the word cyanide, it's a very serious gas that you want, if that's what it is, you want to know right away. So we're hearing now that it's probably not that. Yeah. So that's a relief.
Yeah, I and certainly our team, we hadn't heard of something like this happening before. But sometimes when these kinds of stories, you know, are posted and there are headlines and it goes far beyond where it actually happened, people come forward and say, oh, this happened in this town or in the U.S. or somewhere else. Have you heard anything like that?
I mean, obviously, if you read the comments on some of the social media posts and stuff, yeah, we're reading other things like this hotel, like the same hotel, other hotels. But yeah, like it's wild, like how it doesn't happen that often, but like you hope it never happens again. If anything comes out of this, it's that the hotels have better regulations to make sure that this doesn't happen on a busy weekend full of kids. Yeah. They're taking their care.
What might this mean for future family trips?
I mean, definitely going to be asking the question at the at the hotel before we go in the pool. Right now, my kids don't want to go in the pool at a hotel anymore. So we'll see. But they're little, so they may get over it. We'll see.
Well, Jennifer, I'm glad Oliver is doing okay now. I appreciate this. Thank you. Please take care.
Thank you.
Jennifer Stevenson's son fell ill from a suspected chlorine leak at a Canmore hotel. We reached her in Calgary, Alberta. Malcolm Ashford has been on the ice for some of the biggest games in hockey, not as a player, but as a linesman and referee. Over a decade, he officiated nearly 1,000 NHL games and then went on to work as an off-ice official with the league in Vancouver. Today, as a high-performance officiating supervisor, he helps coach the new generation of referees in British Columbia. And Mr. Ashford recently learned that later this summer, he'll be inducted into the BC Hall of Fame. He told the CBC about the moment he got that news.
It's pretty special. When I first got the phone call, actually on New Year's Eve, from Pat Lawyer, the executive director, it was kind of a combination of emotion and elation, I guess I'd call it. First of all, the emotions kind of kicked in. I think I got a little teary-eyed, actually, at the time, but it certainly makes you pretty pleased. And then, of course, the excitement kicks in after that. So it was a great news, and it was pretty humbling. After spending all that time in the world of officiating and doing something that you really love and you really enjoy, to be recognized for it at the end of the day is pretty special. So I'm looking forward to July in Penticton.
You moved to BC from England at the age of 11. How did you find your way into hockey in the first place?
Well, when I got to Victoria, my family emigrated to Victoria when I was 11 years old, and I started going to school there, obviously. And my buddies in school, the young guys I was hanging with, were all playing hockey, obviously, which is a Canadian thing to do, right? Hockey night in Canada, yeah. Coast to coast. And so basically, but they were so far ahead of me. They'd been skating and playing hockey since they were 4 or 5 years old, and here I am at 11, hadn't even put on a pair of skates. So when I started skating and playing hockey, I thought, well, the only way I'm going to get better and get my skating up is to get more ice time. And so I started refereeing when I was 13 years old, and I gradually got to the point where I enjoyed the refereeing more than the playing aspect of it. And when I was 18 years old, I made up my mind that I wanted to referee in the NHL. And I kind of set my sights on that as an 18-year-old. And I was fortunate along the way. I had a couple of good breaks. And I ended up signing my contract, turning pro when I was 22.
Wow, so that was, you would have been one of the youngest refs
in the
NHL.
I was actually the second youngest referee in the NHL ever, which was kind of neat, but kind of scary. You know, you're a 22-year-old, you've got to travel coast to coast, make your own travel arrangements, get out there and referee in front of 18,000 people, which is a little scary at times.
And you were reffing, 69 to 79, so that's an era when the NHL was a little bit more rough and tumble, too, wasn't it?
Yeah, we had the old Philadelphia Broad Street Bullies in those days. It was good hockey. There was only 12 teams in the league at that point in time. It was a different kind of hockey in those days, and the officiating staff was different. I got the pleasure of working with some pretty good referees in those days that were very experienced, very well respected officials. They taught me a lot and helped me along the way.
Longtime hockey official Malcolm Ashford talking to the CBC's Doug Herbert this morning.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
And And you are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 in Brainerd,